From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We begin today with a short update on a large industrial fire still burning in Rockton, Illinois, a town near the Wisconsin border. The fire started Monday morning after an explosion at the Chemtool plant, which makes industrial lubricant. Health officials have evacuated residents within a one-mile radius of the fire, citing potentially hazardous chemicals in the air. Our partner station, WNIJ, also reports that state health officials are recommending anyone within 3 miles of the site wear masks or face coverings to prevent them from breathing in soot from the fire. Winnebago County Health Administrator Sandra Martell is also telling residents, if you find waste related to the fire in your yard, steer clear.
We do not know what that waste contains. Please do not handle it with bare hands. Use a shovel, use gloves, and sequester it, meaning keep it separate from your household waste so that we know how to properly dispose of it.
So far, there are no serious injuries from the fire, but it is expected to burn for several days. Emergency crews are not using water to douse the flames because they're worried it would help chemicals from the plant flow into the nearby Rock River. You can get the latest updates on the evacuation orders from the Village of Rockton Facebook page, which is Village of Rockton IL. And our partner station, WNIJ in DeKalb, is also following the story and will have updates. Okay, on with today's show. If you've been following the news lately, you've probably been hearing more and more about ransomware attacks. The Colonial Pipeline has gotten the most attention. It caused a shortage of gasoline for weeks on the East Coast. But there have been attacks across America, including in Illinois. In the past year, several organizations here have been compromised by ransomware groups, which often demand payment in cryptocurrency under threat of compromising services or leaking sensitive data. Last year, in April, as COVID-19 was forcing Illinois Valley Community College in Oglesby to transition to online classes, hackers locked the college out of its own network, crashing its website and email systems. More recently, this spring, the Illinois Attorney General's office was breached by a ransomware group known as Doppelpaymer, believed to have links to Russia. It was reported that after ransom negotiations broke down, the group leaked some of the data online, including documents relating to court cases and prisoners. The hack came after an audit last year warning the AG's office of its vulnerabilities in cybersecurity. Then, in May, a ransomware group calling itself Grief claimed it hacked St. Clair County, stealing 2.5 gigabytes of sensitive data and bringing down the county's website. Grief demanded payment in cryptocurrencies, including Bitcoin. Joining us now to discuss the proliferation of ransomware attacks in Illinois and across the country and how you can protect yourself or your business are A.J. Wiesens. He's a reporter for Mother Jones covering cybersecurity. A.J., welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
Curtis Minder is CEO and co-founder of GroupSense, a cyber reconnaissance and digital risk company, and the subject of a recent New Yorker profile, How to Negotiate with Ransomware Hackers. Curtis is also a native of Chatham, Illinois, just outside Springfield. Curtis, welcome to the 21st.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's an honor.
And Calvin Nobles is associate professor and chair of the Department of Information Technology and Management at the Illinois Institute of Technology. He previously worked as a cryptologic warfare officer in the United States Navy and as a cybersecurity professional for Wells Fargo. Calvin, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Listeners, our lines are open for your calls. 800-222-9455 is the number. If you have any questions about ransomware or cybersecurity or any comments, give us a call. 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. You can also tweet us at 21st Show. AJ, I'm going to begin with you. You've been covering the recent proliferation of ransomware attacks from the Colonial Pipeline to the Illinois Attorney General's office. What have you learned in your reporting about this proliferation of ransomware recently?
Well, I think one of the key points here is that the targets for this sort of activity really, you know, it spans the whole spectrum of types of businesses you can think of, all the way from the small mom and pop shops up to the major international corporations. These are really targets of opportunity, and it's primarily financially driven. There's just so much money in this sort of activity for these actors that it's really the driving factor here. It's money. It's the relative ease of pulling it off and getting away with it. And so it's really just a really troubling situation.
What do we know about the attack on the Illinois Attorney General's office? What happened there?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I'm looking at the group's page right now. They're on their website, and those files are still up. They claim to have 200 gigabytes of confidential information, like you said, that include what appears to be, you know, folks' email accounts, case files, scans of stuff, contracts. I'm just sort of scrolling here. The word confidential appears a lot. You know, what happened here is just some flaw in their cybersecurity setup allowed this sort of thing to happen, and they, you know, took advantage and went for it.
Curtis, why now? What are the conditions for which, you know, ransomware attacks that they seem to be proliferating now, or is it just that there's more attention on them now?
Well, ransomware has been a thing for a very long time. There's been different versions of this. The early versions of ransomware, they were often exchanging gift cards for payment and things like that. I think part of the reason why this is becoming more and more prolific is the anonymity that digital currency affords and the ability to do large transfers of money anonymously. Also the amnesty and protection of certain nation states like Russia who don't prosecute the folks perpetrating these crimes. And then, you know, probably mostly it is the cyber hygiene landscape that allows them, or the lack thereof, that allows them the access to get to the victims.
When you say the cyber hygiene landscape, I mean, we were talking before the show among the producers, and, you know, those of us of a certain age remember when you couldn't use a computer without 18, you know, virus warnings popping up from McAfee or, you know, Windows or something like that. Is, you know, is the technology just not keeping up with the threats, or is it something else going on?
Well, that's kind of the frustrating thing for us in the industry as practitioners. You know, our business is responding to these ransomware events, and every time we're taking inventory of how the threat actors gained access to the victim, and it boils down to a pretty short list of well-known vulnerabilities and unsophisticated attacks. So these are things that are pretty much avoidable or preventable on the front end if we, you know, maintain our systems properly.
And Calvin, maybe I can bring you into the conversation now. Can you talk a little bit about the mechanics of a ransomware attack? What actually happens? How are people gaining access to these kind of systems? How do they communicate with the owners of the systems? What actually happens in the real world?
Sure, absolutely. What we're seeing is mostly these ransomware attacks initially start through some form of spear phishing or some form of phishing, where they are able to capture an employee's credentials, their logon credentials, and able to gain access to the network illegally and traverse the network that way. One of the other vectors that they're able to gain access to the network is through organizations not updating the patching of their software and their systems. And so those are the two biggest vectors that they use to gain access to a network. And so by doing that, it's very important for organizations to really ensure that their systems are updated with the latest patch or patches, and to make sure that you have a strong security awareness and a strong security training program. And that security awareness and that security training is constantly reinforced, because as the cyber threat landscapes change and moves, when it comes to ransomware attacks, that we're talking about just thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of variants of ransomware that's created daily and monthly. So to give these cyber criminals an advantage. And the strategic advantage that cyber criminals have over organizations who are working very hard to maintain their network and protect their infrastructure is that it's easier for cyber criminals to engineer an attack than what it takes for an organization to defend and to come up with an engineering solution to counter that offensive attack that they're doing. So it's kind of like they have the strategic advantage. And the other thing that we're seeing right now, we're beginning to see ransomware as a service. And so this is cyber criminals working together to offer these services at a very low cost for an individual or organizations that want to do harm or damage to another entity.
Listeners, if you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking about ransomware attacks and the proliferation of ransomware attacks. And a little later, we're going to be talking about what you can do to secure yourself and your organization. We're talking with Calvin Nobles, who's with the Department of Information Technology at the Illinois Institute of Technology. Curtis Minder, CEO of GroupSense, which is a cybersecurity reconnaissance digital risk company. And AJ Wiesens, who's a reporter from Mother Jones. Curtis, I want to ask you, can you talk about the human factor here, right? I worked for an organization a few years ago that had some cybersecurity training called Securing the Human. Is that a major point of vulnerability these days?
It certainly plays a big factor. Calvin alluded to, the attack vectors, like fake phishing, for example, are still highly effective. Those are targeted at human failures, people clicking on the links, installing malware inadvertently. So yes, it's certainly a part of it. And
maybe when you say phishing, just in case some listeners are not aware, this is you get an email, it looks like it's from a colleague or maybe from your company's HR, but if you actually look at the URL, it's some crazy combination of letters or something like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that is still a common attack vector. The other thing I wanted to mention from attack vector's perspective or how the threat actors are actually gaining access, and we saw this with Colonial, is it's not so much the human part, it is just not maintaining their systems. So in the case of Colonial, they were able to get access to a VPN concentrator that allows for remote access into the network that had not been properly configured with multi-factor authentication. The human element of that, though, was that one of the employees had allegedly used that same corporate credential or that corporate login to sign up for a third-party site outside of Colonial that was hacked. And they took that credential from the third-party site and used it on the VPN concentrator, and it worked. And so the human part is, the person inside the company was misusing their corporate credentials outside the organization.
Interesting. All right. We have a phone call on the line, 800-222-9455, if you want to join our conversation. Laura is calling in from Rockton. Laura, thanks for calling in.
Hi. My question is, why do these folks demand payment in cryptocurrency rather than dollars? Someone earlier said something about anonymity, but I don't understand how that works.
Okay, Laura, thank you. Thank you for the call. Stay safe in Rockton, too, as well, where the fire is still burning. Curtis, maybe you can take that. Why cryptocurrency as opposed to good old U.S. dollars?
Yeah, so, obviously we've got a historic system of tracking the movement of U.S. currency, whether it's electronic or physical, across borders. There are all kinds of laws for reporting when wire transfers occur between banks across borders. All of these things are very carefully tracked. With cryptocurrency, it is built in such a way, and it's fairly technical, but it's built in such a way that those things are not able to be tracked. It functions on a system called the blockchain, and the blockchain basically allows transactions to occur without the identification of the two parties involved. Just to simplify this, when a threat actor is demanding a ransom, at some point during the negotiation with the threat actor, they're going to provide you a Bitcoin wallet address. That address is just a number. We don't know where that address necessarily is physically in the world, and we don't know who owns it, and we don't have to. It's very difficult for law enforcement and regulatory bodies to track this. The last thing I'll say is there are other kinds of cryptocurrencies beyond Bitcoin. And we saw with the Colonial attack that the FBI was able to find that Bitcoin wallet and get some of the money back in the case of Colonial. There are other cryptocurrencies that threat actors are using that make this even more difficult than the Bitcoin platform specifically. To answer her question, these were designed deliberately in this fashion to decentralize the exchange of currency.
And we need to take a break here in a moment. But Calvin, before we do, what do you say to people who say, why are we even negotiating with these people? We shouldn't give in. Why is that not perceived as a realistic outcome for some of these organizations that are negotiating and are paying the ransoms?
So the first thing first is that, one, companies are really trying to minimize the reputational damage that comes from being involved in a ransomware attack. But at the same time, companies are also concerned with maintaining their operational continuity. How do you maintain your operations when, one, you don't have access to files, or all of your files are encrypted? And so imagine if you were like a hospital and you needed those files and you needed that data to run that hospital, to run the hospital safely, or if you were like a community college and you needed that information to run safely, then you might consider negotiating with the cyber criminals to pay the ransom, hoping that they will release your data or release the encryption on your data. And but the point here is that a lot of times they don't. And so that is why the FBI and then several other federal agencies are saying don't pay the ransom. And so that puts companies in a very difficult situation of not paying the ransom, but the companies are trying to pay the ransom to make sure they maintain their operational continuity and be able to provide a service to the consumers or the customers.
Okay, we need to take a break. We have a caller on the line. Please stick with us. We will get to your question when we come back. We are talking about the proliferation of ransomware attacks. 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455 is the number. We're going to talk about what you can do to protect yourself, your organization. After a short break, you're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about the proliferation of ransomware attacks on government entities, businesses, organizations, including right here in Illinois. Our guests are A.J. Vicens, a reporter from Mother Jones, Curtis Minder, CEO of GroupSense, which is a cybersecurity reconnaissance and digital risk company, and Calvin Nobles, associate professor and chair of the Department of Information Technology and Management at the Illinois Institute of Technology. We're taking your calls, 800-222-9455. And I want to go now to Wendy, as on the line from Winnebago. Wendy, thank you for calling in.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I have a concern. I bank at a small town bank in my community, and I am worried about how likely it is that my accounts are safe. Part of the attraction is they want us to do all online banking. We don't get any hard copies of our bank statements. Since the last couple of attacks, I've started taking screenshots of my bank balances because I have no other way to prove how much money I have in the bank if my bank gets attacked. How silly is this precaution that I'm trying to take to protect myself?
All right, Wendy, thank you for the call. Calvin, I wonder if you want to weigh in on that. Screenshots of your bank balance, is that going to help if there is some sort of attack?
You know, from being a former bank employee, I would tell you that banks are working extremely hard and making sure, one, they're meeting regulatory compliance, but also making sure that they are meeting the security requirements necessary to protect their customers' resources. And so I personally don't think it's necessary to take the screenshots, but also tell, you know, customers, whatever make you comfortable. Just know that banks are working very hard. They have pretty solid security practices and countermeasures in place to prevent something like this from happening. However, in the security world, we always say nothing is 100% secure, but I do believe that banks are one of the industries that are working extremely hard, and rightfully so, to make sure that they are protecting their customers' resources.
AJ, you in your reporting, you mentioned that there's a belief that some of these hacks are linked potentially to the Russian government. What do we know about who and where these attacks are coming from?
What we know is that a lot of these groups seem to be operating either out of Russia or countries within the Russian sphere of influence. But a lot of professionals will tell you that, and researchers will tell you that it's not necessarily the Russian government telling groups to go after this company or go after that company. It's more of a look the other way type of situation, where they're not necessarily going after these criminal gangs once they're identified or pointed out. And in some cases, there seems to be a collaboration. Perhaps these groups end up targeting an organization that has sensitive material, intelligence-worthy material, and that information is either shared back and forth or some level of coordination beyond just a look the other way situation. So it gets very, very tricky at that point. I mean, Curtis might have a better view into this, but because of this exact dynamic, it makes paying the ransoms tricky in some cases. I mean, some of these groups are federally sanctioned bodies, and so giving money to them or facilitating payments could end up getting you in trouble with the government. So it becomes very, very tricky to deal with. And obviously something, the complicated nature of it is one of the reasons why it's risen to the desk of President Biden, who's scheduled to talk with the president of Russia about this very issue tomorrow. So it's a very tricky geopolitical issue that doesn't have any easy answers.
Yeah, Curtis, maybe you can weigh in on that. You were featured in a recent piece in The New Yorker. You've negotiated ransom payments. What can you tell us about the motivations of some of these groups?
Well, I mean, the motivations, I think AJ said at the beginning of the show, are monetary in nature.
Simple answer.
It's that simple. The comment that AJ made around the sanctions, that is true. It is tricky, as you know, in the industry we're in, it's very difficult to do what we call attribution or basically correctly identify the individual who's involved in these attacks. The Office of Foreign Asset Control has a list of countries and organizations and individuals that you shall not transact business with under any circumstances. And so one of the things we're responsible for when we're working with a victim is identifying to the best of our ability whether the person on the other end perpetrating the attack is on these lists, right? And we do that a number of technical ways, but it is something to consider.
So Curtis, what should people, organizations, individuals especially who are listening to this be doing to protect themselves? We were looking on your company GroupSense's Twitter page, and the bio reads, among other things, please stop reusing passwords, just please. I mean, is that the top advice you'd give to people?
Yeah, so there is, like I said, we take inventory when we do a response, an incident response on these ransomware attacks. Of how the threat actors gained access to the victim. And it culminates in a pretty short list of basic cyber hygiene things. And so password policy is one of those. That password policy includes the complexity and the reuse of those passwords, but then also the use of that corporate credential outside the organization, like I used in the example with Colonial. Multi-factor authentication, meaning using a device to augment your password. Usually that's an app on your phone or a token, a hardware token, to add a second layer beyond your password, a third layer of authentication. Extremely effective. One of the things we saw during COVID that contributed to the uptick in victims is people were allowing remote access into their offices and their networks for their employees and executives, and they weren't securing those things properly. And what happens often in many of the cases, you know, someone tactically asks for access to a system, the IT department sets that access up and they forget about it. And the threat actors will find that and exploit it. So securing the remote access is also critical. And then of course, good backups that doesn't hurt. There's a whole discussion around backups and what's effective and what's not, but having backups is a necessary precaution.
Okay, well, this is a story that I suspect we are not done with, so we will continue to follow it. I want to thank my guests. Curtis Minder is CEO of GroupSense. Calvin Nobles is chair of the Department of Information Technology and Management at the Illinois Institute of Technology. And AJ Vicens is a reporter from Mother Jones. Thank you all so much for being with us and talking about this today on the 21st.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.